Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Like The Art of the Deal, everybody read The Art. Who has read The Art of the Deal in this room? Everybody. I always say, a deep, deep second to the Bible. The Bible is the best, the Bible.
Most importantly, I brought my Bible.
The Bible means a lot to me, but I don't want to get into specifics.
Why do I have to, you know, repent? Why do I have to ask for forgiveness if you're not making mistakes?
I figure it's probably, maybe the only way I'm going to get to heaven. So I better do a good job.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast. I'm Virginia Heffernan. On TrumpCast today, we are clinging to guns and religion. Okay, just religion. In part to throw off the assumption that we are coastal elites still crying into our lattes because we lost that election. See, Tommy Lahren, I'm just trying to do your work for you. Today's topic is indeed religion, Trump's religion, the conundrum of how so many white evangelicals, former espousers of so-called family values, and I don't mean so-called in a sneering way, I mean family values was really what they were called. So former espousers of good, true, normal family values, they voted for Donald Trump. And he's on the record as a foe of family values, a hater of the weak and disabled, a carouser, a mauler of bodies, not his wife's, a rejecter, no doubt, of those chaste Mormon undergarments Mitt Romney wears, a philanderer and a draft dodger. And okay, you know this litany. It's practically a psalm by now. But the former family values crowd voted for a wrecker of families. Huh? They used to think a single divorce or a frisky afternoon on a yacht like that one Gary Hart had disqualified people from the presidency. But Trump is different. For their part, evangelicals have gamely tried to square the circle, and to do so, they don't explain away Trump's unchristian ways. Instead, they find in him other virtues. For one, he's rich. And as the Bible says, the tax-dodging billionaires shall inherit the earth. It's something like that. And then some Trumpite evangelicals have gone so far as to make this elegant argument in likening Trump to Cyrus the Great, a pagan king, godless, a bulldozer, but an unwitting aid of the Jews who encouraged them to return to their temple and rebuild it. I find that one fascinating. To illuminate this complex issue, I turn to Reza Aslan, the religious scholar. But first, some announcements. TrumpCast is going to be live this weekend at the Tribeca Film Festival. That's Sunday, April 30th at 8:15 p.m. Tickets are still available right now at slate.com/live. So go grab them while you can and join me, Jacob Weisberg, and Jamel Bowie as we discuss Trump's first 100 days and more. Again, tickets are still available at slate.com/live. Also, the TrumpCast Book Club, hosted by Jacob Weisberg, has been recorded, and it's a great one. We'll be posting that show sometime next week. So if you haven't read Herman Melville's The Confidence Man, you've got one more weekend to catch up and find out what this classic American satire can tell us about our president. My guest today is Reza Aslan. He's written three books on religion, No God But God, which is about Islam, Beyond Fundamentalism, which is about religious extremism, and Zealot, which is about Jesus of Nazareth. Aslan's a member of the American Academy of Religion, the Society of Biblical Literature, and the International Quranic Studies Association. He's also professor of creative writing at the University of California at Riverside. Okay, Reza, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So I want to talk about Donald Trump, the would-be Presbyterian. He did go to Marble Collegiate Church as a child, or claims he did. The church says they have no record of it, but who cares? Let's ignore it. That's such a minor lie.
Wait. Do you think Trump might be lying?
I'm sure he's misremembering. I'm sure it's just a small error. But Trump seems to be the first sort of floridly irreligious president we've had in a long time.
We don't
know if he's an atheist. We don't know what he thinks about God. He uses the word. He doesn't use the word. What do you make of this?
I think he thinks he's God. Irreligious is one way of putting it. This is a man whose entire life, I mean, the greed, the lack of empathy, the racism, the misogyny, I mean, everything about his life stands in direct contrast to what we have in at least the American political landscape over the last 60, 70 years have come to expect from someone running for the highest office, which is that not only do you need to be Christian, specifically Christian, but you also need to be able to speak the language of Christianity, the language that has the most currency for the masses. After all, we are a country that is 71% Christian. And so, you know, in a democracy, you would assume that in order to gather that population to you, to vote for you, that you need to be able to speak to them. And Donald Trump has, I think, turned that on its head. Now, I think it's a little bit more complicated than this, obviously, because the evangelical, particularly the white evangelical community in the United States has changed dramatically over the last decade. Let's begin by just acknowledging one very important fact, which is that 81% of white evangelicals voted for Trump. That's a record. That's more white evangelicals than voted for George Bush, who was a white evangelical.
Right, and very vocal about it. That's amazing.
And very vocal about it.
So what does that mean? I mean, so many of us during the primaries thought, well, he's never going to win when it comes to, you know, the states that we associate with religion and mega churches.
Right.
And he did. Tell us.
Okay, it's a few things. Number one, let's focus on the white part for a minute, because we can't ignore that. I mean, the fact of the matter is that non-white evangelicals voted 67-24% for Clinton. So this isn't just about the evangelical part, it's about the white part. And it's certainly true that a lot of the identity politics that Trump played with, this sort of resurgence of white nationalism, this conception of, you know, going back to a time, quote, in which America used to be great, that sense of nostalgia for what America used to be. The very clear, I'm not even going to use the word dog whistle because it wasn't a dog whistle, it was about as clear as it gets.
It was definitely the in appeal. Range of most human ears.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. The appeal to whiteness and white identity worked very well for these white evangelicals. You know, Sojourners, a liberal evangelical magazine, made it very clear. They said that, look, white evangelicals, quote, acted more white than evangelical. Mm. And by the way, that still continues to this day. Two-thirds of white evangelicals strongly approve of Trump's performance. So let's not play around with it. Race played a huge role in the enormous support of white evangelicals for Trump. But there was something else, too, and that is that Trump had this ability to very explicitly promise secular power to Christian evangelicals in this country. I mean, I heard this repeatedly from, you know, some members of my extended family who are white evangelicals who did vote for Donald Trump. You have to understand that over the last decade and a half or so, white evangelicals pretty much lost the culture wars in America, right? It's over. I mean, we were celebrating the end of the culture wars a few years ago, you know, certainly with the Supreme Court's legalization of same-sex marriage. That was kind of, you know, for many of us, the end of the line for the whole back and forth between the culture wars in the United States. But that left, I think, a lot of white evangelicals feeling not just that as though they had lost the culture wars, but that they had been left behind in some way. What you hear a lot from this community is this sense of siege, right? That, you know, majorities of white evangelicals feel as though their very quote unquote rights are under siege by America, that, that Christians are being oppressed in the United States because, I don't know, Starbucks changed the color of their cups, you know, their holiday cups, or, you know, because, of this whole nonsense about whether you can say Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays. And I think for a lot of those Christians, Donald Trump very explicitly said to them that he would give them power again, that he would make them great again. You heard this from Franklin Graham, you know, these, this promise that Christians would have the secular power to enforce their beliefs on society and to have a seat at the table of power. And it worked. Okay. I mean, look, it's, I just want to say there's a one-to-one correlation here. I'm not just kind of, you know, talking off the cuff. Today, Christians, white evangelicals in the United States have gone over the course of, you know, two election cycles. So let's say 2008 to today, they have gone from being the most likely group to say that morality has a role to play in how you judge candidates for office, to the least likely group in America to say that morality has a role to play in judging a politician. Atheists in America are far more likely to say that a politician's morality should play a role in whether they deserve the job or not than white evangelicals in America.
I mean, that's incredibly rich. I think that there's some threads to pull apart here, maybe for me and our listeners, namely that it's possible that at least in the public square as represented on Twitter, the moral life lives less in our sexual and familial practices and more now in our relationship to liberal ideals, to in particular to race. So, you know, you cite someone for racism, but adultery and abortion and promiscuity don't register anymore. So it's possible, isn't it, that the evangelicals, when they say they don't want to be faulted for moral failings, that those moral failings are the ones that they get faulted for, which is, you know, intolerance and you know, potentially racism or regionalism or a lack of worldliness or commitment to globalism, that morality too has been redefined.
I think that's a very sophisticated argument, but I don't think it's one that is at play for the vast majority of those white evangelicals who voted for Donald Trump, because they themselves have made it very clear. I don't think that they're making an argument about, you know, an argument that's connected to their own sense of, let's say, nebulous morality in a ever graying globalized world. As a matter of fact, 72% of white evangelicals say that there should actually be a wall between a politician's private and public life.
Mm.
Now, I just want to remind you that these are the people that we used to refer to as values voters. So we, they're
yes.
not, that's it. So there it is right there. We cannot call them values voters anymore because quite clearly values just don't matter. I'm not, this is, the data is there. They don't care anymore. But I will say one thing that's also important about this, which is that a whopping 74% of white evangelicals say that that American culture has shifted in negative ways, right? That they, that I used this phrase before, they feel left behind by the movement of American culture. And I also don't think that it is a coincidence that people of color are making up a larger and larger share of America's Christian population. In fact, demographers say that by 2042, the majority of Christians in America will be people of color. The values, as we saw in this last election, the values of Christians of color, be they African American or Latino or Korean or what have you, are vastly at odds with the values that are being promoted by white evangelicals. And it all goes back to this notion that, you know, many white evangelicals, and this is a movement that's been going on for quite some time now, believe that the symbols of Christianity deserve cultural dominance in America, right? This is the whole notion of Christian nationalism. America is a Christian nation founded on Christian ideals, and our laws and our morality have to change so that they are in alignment with biblical values. You've heard this argument for years and years and years among, you know, certain evangelical groups, white evangelical groups.
And you hear it reprised a little bit by in the current administration by Steve Bannon. Even though he's identified with the Catholic Church, and the history of Christianity in the U.S. is so extraordinarily rich, as you better than anyone has explained. But you know, Bannon is a Catholic on a continuum, I think, with Opus Dei, the Latin Mass preaching. I mean, he's very, very high church and would have been regarded with great suspicion by the Protestant majority not long ago. I mean, you know, Kennedy's still the first and only Catholic president. Pence has made great pains to distance himself, taken pains to distance himself from Catholicism. In any case, we have a Catholic very close to the president who espouses, you know, this clash of civilizations defense of, quote, Judeo-Christian values, which taken all together don't conjure the image of either the mainline Protestant faiths or Catholicism, which is heavily identified with Latin countries, but whiteness, that it's, you know,
whiteness,
to put,
yeah,
Christianity, which in the U.S. is represented by so many descendants of empire nations who got their Christianity from missionaries, you know, including the giant Korean Protestant Presbyterian sect, or the many derivations of Baptist sect. And, you know, that was an extraordinarily heterogeneous population. And then suddenly Christianity means anti-Islam.
I was waiting for one of us to say that, because you're right. Like, you know, what does the white evangelical, you know, living in the Midwest have in common with, you know, Steve Bannon's pre-Vatican II Catholicism? And that is fear of Islam. I mean, that's exactly what it is. You know, Bannon has managed in a brilliant way to wrap up the sort of sense of siege that a lot of white evangelicals feel by giving it a name. You know, it's not just globalism. And by the way, it's not just Islam. It's also, you know, stark anti-Semitism. I mean, the Judeo-Christian thing is nonsense. That's just code word for American Protestantism, really. But the point being that what Bannon has done in this sort of bizarre clash of civilizations mentality that he has brought into the White House is to give a name and an identity to the nebulous fear that a lot of these white evangelicals have. And, you know, we're talking about Christian dominionism. You know, that's very much a part of Bannon's worldview. I mean, he himself, regardless of whatever his spirituality is, wants to define Christian civilization and to make it synonymous with white civilization. And he's not the only one in the administration. I mean, look, you know, Rick Perry is a member of the New Apostolic Reformation. This is this organization that clamors for a Christian takeover of the entire United States government. Betsy DeVos is a member of the Christian Reformist Movement. This is a movement that has for years been advocating education reform in America to, quote, advance God's kingdom. You know, Kellyanne Conway is a number of Christian dominionists in the administration. Mike Pence, of course, is a Christian dominionist and a biblical literalist. And then I would actually say one other thing, by the way, that doesn't get talked about enough when it comes to Trump's appeal to these white evangelicals, and that's the concept of the prosperity gospel. Are you familiar with the prosperity gospel, right? This idea that
let's reprise it.
Well, it's been around for about two decades here in the United States, enormously successful. This is the message preached by these charlatans like T.D. Jakes and Joel Osteen, the message of which is that what God wants for you is material prosperity and indeed that material prosperity, this is going all the way back to, you know, the old Calvinism, right? That material prosperity is an indication of God's divine grace. So you look at a man like Donald Trump, who stands against everything Jesus died for. His very life is basically a spit in Jesus's face. And yet his prosperity fits very easily into this notion of the prosperity gospel, right? That he's rich, he has material success. And so it's very easy to just assume that is some kind of divine grace or divine blessing. And, you know, all of this plays into this record-shattering support for this despicable man.
We sometimes mull on this show, let's face it, it's just me that thinks about it still, but about Trump's appearance, his aesthetic, his, you know, his the gildedness and certainly the way that he manages his person. You know, you might actually liken him. He looks not unlike Jim Baker and certain televangelists of the 80s. I mean, that was the sort of the hairspray, the talking straight to the camera. It's sort of, you know, reality television, having been on a few TV sets. One of the things that amazes me is that sort of Barnum and Bailey world where it's only the facade, like literally the facade, like things look like a mahogany desk from the front, but they're staple gunned in the back. And there is a way that Trump doesn't care about the underside of things, the tape on his tie and so on. So, and that to me does suggest that relentlessly, quite literally evangelical sales approach to religion that is in some ways intrinsic to Christianity, which is a proselytizing religion. It makes it easy to convert. And it's not, and I say this as a church-going Episcopalian, you know, the effort to lower the bar to membership and also offer some sweet incentives. I've also, for whatever reason, spent some time as a Jew. I converted and lived as a Jew for 10 years. And, you know, that's a religion that asks you to please not convert to it. And, yeah. You know, so, and there's less a tradition of sales. There's less a tradition of Paul, you know, wandering all over with Bibles, trying to make converts. And there's less an empire tradition of building empire through conversion. I guess the point is that I think sales and Christianity go well together.
And I think you're right. I would just say, I think specifically in American Christianity. I mean, you know, you're not going to make that argument in Nicaragua, right? Nobody in El Salvador is going to pay any attention to what you just said. But, you know, in Iowa, yeah, what you said makes perfect sense. You know, we have so effortlessly married not just capitalism and Christianity, but nationalism, patriotism and Christianity. You know, you have now today, as we sit here, 57%, according to the latest Pew polling, 57% of white evangelicals say that it is vital to be Christian to be considered American. And that's an astonishing number, except that 30% of just mainline Protestants, you know, Episcopalians, Presbyterians, also believe that it's important to be Christian to be considered American. This idea of the marriage of the cross and the flag, you know, these two symbols bleeding into one, has been a part of, you know, American Christianity for quite some time. It's just that we've never had a politician like Trump come out and just explicitly say, vote for me and I will put power in your hands. This idea of like a nostalgia for white Christian America, the quote, good old days. You know what I mean?
Yes.
The good old days, you know, when, you know, you prayed in school and no damn ACLU, you know, Jewish commies would tell you you couldn't.
I mean, this the point that has sort of evolved from what you're saying that I had not. I mean, I'm undergoing a kind of conversion myself right here. I hadn't realized that Christian had become code for white.
Yeah, and again, I just want to one more time just say we're talking about evangelical Christianity, right? Not mainline Christian denominations like Presbyterians or Episcopalians. And evangelicals, of course, make up by far the largest Christian group in America. I mean, they dwarf all other Christian groups in the United States. You know, by some estimates, a full third of all Americans are evangelical. So we're talking, you know, 110, 120 million people, maybe.
And that's far more than identify as Catholics.
Far in the United States, far, far more than identify as Catholics. Yeah, I mean, not even in the same ballpark. I do want to say one thing that's kind of interesting about what you were saying, which is just about Christianity, not evangelical Christianity. We've seen this incredible pendulum swing over the last, 8, 9 years, 10 years. So in 2008, 54% of America was both white and Christian. In 2015, that number had dropped to 45%. And so you are seeing, I think, you know, a sort of a contraction, if you will, of the white Christian identity in the United States because of immigration patterns, certainly because of Latinos. But again, when you go back to evangelicalism, you are still seeing a movement that is dominated by white people. Although, again, as I had said before, that's going to change. You know, I mean, we are seeing more and more people of color taking over the U.S. Christian population. As I said, by 2042, people of color will be the majority of Christians in the United States. But I think this is what's important to understand, is that it's threatening to fracture, if not absolutely destroy, the white evangelical community, not just because of the hand-wringing that we've seen by many white evangelical leaders, male and female, who are just decrying, you know, the absolute appalling nature of support among, you know, people who are following Donald Trump, you know, right or wrong, but also because you're going to see whites make up a fewer percentage of these evangelical communities. And as I said, people of color, be they evangelical or not, have different values than white evangelicals do. And so, it's hard to say where we're going to be 10 years from now, how this discussion is going to change 10 years from now. But the moral majority is done. Value voters are over. And Trump, in the way that he might break all of America, has broken the white evangelical community.
I mean, it may be that, and I guess we got to wrap up, but it may be that the relatively short reign of evangelicals as synonymous with Christians. I remember first getting to college in the South. I'd grown up an Episcopalian. Friends of mine went to the Methodist Church. We were in New England, so there were Congregationalists, Unitarians, certainly Roman Catholics. And I met some people who identified as Christian, and I waited for them to tell me what kind. But no, they were just Christian. So I suddenly thought, wow, they've built a world where this is just Christianity, and they're not hair splitting over fascinating things like the schism in the Episcopal Church that 14 of us took an interest in. But it may be that that evangelicals, that idea of Christian as a monolith might resplinter along interesting lines, possibly along racial cultural lines.
Well, I will say one fascinating thing to keep an eye on now as we move forward into this, you know, Trump era, is the resurgence of liberal evangelicalism.
Mm.
And I think particularly among the youth, I mean, you saw something remarkable happen with Franklin Graham, is that his students rebelled against him. His students started, you know, writing letters, posting, you know, protests, essentially saying, stop speaking for us, right? Your support of Trump, it doesn't fit with our values. And so younger evangelicals are now, I think, starting to really, it's a day of reckoning. It's a day of reckoning. It's impossible as an evangelical, if you're a white evangelical and you are looking at that 81% of your community voted for a man who has been accused of rape on multiple occasions, mm-hmm. who has been repeatedly sued for sexual harassment, who has boasted of sexual assault, who has given nothing to anyone, who literally gives not two shits about the poor or the weak or the orphaned or anyone, who, again, whose very existence is a slap in the face to Jesus Christ, then you got to figure out what's gone wrong. Something has gone wrong. And I think that you're seeing this now. So I'm really curious to see how the evangelical community itself is going to rise up and push back against this sort of devil's bargain, power in exchange for morals.
I mean, that is a great way to end it. As usual, Trump represents a complete, or has forced a complete audit on all of our values in America, and certainly our relationship with religion and morality. Thank you so much, Raisa, for being here.
You got it. It was a pleasure.
That's it for today's show. TrumpCast is produced by Jason DeLeon. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Steve Lichtai. June Thomas is the managing producer of Slate Podcasts. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer at Panoply. And a big congratulations to John DiDomenico, our voice of Donald Trump, who's just won a contest hosted by Daryl Hammond at Los Angeles Laugh Factory for Best Donald Trump Impersonator. He really is the best out there. I'm Virginia Heffernan. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast.